From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The exit path from COVID restrictions is starting to dominate political debate. The Morrison government has its eggs firmly in the basket of the Doherty Institute's modelling, which says that the country can begin loosening restrictions and opening up when vaccination of people 16 and over reaches levels of 70 and 80%. That would not mean life back to normal, but it would mean living with COVID. Cases would increase, and the objective would turn from suppressing COVID to minimising serious illness, hospitalisation and deaths. But the exit path, agreed to in theory by National Cabinet, has in practice put Scott Morrison potentially at odds with Western Australia and Queensland, which are reluctant to give up their status of having little or no COVID. Today, we talk with Sharon Lewin, who is director of the Doherty Institute, to delve into the details and implications of the modelling by the Institute and its partners. Sharon Lewin, the Doherty modelling was based on the assumption that case numbers would be around 30 when the nation opened. But you've since said it doesn't matter if those numbers are much higher, even in the 800s, as we've seen in New South Wales. Can you explain why it makes no difference?
Yeah, sure, Michelle. I'll just start by saying that all the modelling is done by a consortium of modellers that have worked very successfully together for quite some time across Australia. And it's led by Professor Jodie McVernon from the Doherty, and it's been abbreviated to the Doherty modelling, but it is from a large consortium across Australia. And what you say is partially right. I mean, it does matter where you start, but the model still holds that at 70% we can relax restrictions and move from a situation where we are now, where we have the goal of zero COVID, move to phase B where zero COVID is no longer the goal and living with COVID's the goal. Now, what are the differences when you open up with small numbers and large numbers? Just to explain the model was based on an outbreak, a seeding event that started with 30 cases. You start with 30 cases, and if you have no restrictions in place, 30 cases increases significantly over the next 180 days, which is what the modelling covered. If you have partial test, trace, isolate, but not ideal test, trace, isolate, the model predicts that from 30 cases, you'll reach 400,000 cases, roughly, over a six-month period. Now, if you open with many more cases, you're going to reach that peak earlier. That's why the model still holds. However, if you can do test, trace, isolate and some public health measures that allow the transmission potential to be less than one, even with hundreds of cases, then you can still attain a situation where you can safely live with the virus. So one thing that I think is needs to be very clear to people that when we move from phase A to B at 70% of vaccination of the adult population, allowing us to live safely with COVID still requires some public health measures. It still requires an intact test, trace, isolate, quarantine system, and it will require some limited public health measures that may vary over time. Lockdowns will be less likely, but they still may be possible in that period.
Could you just tell us something about the team that put together this model? What sort of experts were there and how many people were involved? What range of institutions?
Yeah, this modelling advice comes from a large team or consortium of mathematical modellers from around the country's multiple institutions led by Professor Jodie McVernon. You know, mathematical modellers can come from different disciplines. They can come from epidemiology, such as Jodie. They can be, pure mathematicians, such as James McCaw. They bring different expertise to understanding and analysing these sorts of complex data sets.
And, of course, they would have to be familiar with a very wide range of overseas literature and modelling there.
Absolutely. And not only just familiar, this group is in constant dialogue with similar consortium around the world, in the UK and Europe and the US, sharing models, sharing experiences, and informing each other what they're doing. So they're very actively engaged internationally as well.
As you say, case numbers would increase quite quickly and sharply when we opened up. Can the Australian health system, in fact, cope with the projected number of cases that we're likely to see in that situation? The AMA Vice President yesterday was warning that a lot of work needed to be done on this front and that hospitals would be under pressure. What about regional hospitals and ICU?
Well, the most important first line of defence is our public health capacity, because the public health capacity, test, trace, isolate, quarantine, is what limits an explosion of cases and keeps the transmission potential less than one. That's really the front line. That has to be robust. We know that tremendous advances have been made in capabilities, but it's not universal across the country. The capacity, and the capacity for what we call optimal test, trace, isolate, quarantine, is far easier when you start with smaller numbers than when you start with, you know, hundreds of cases. Beyond that, so that's the first line of defence. It has to be intact and functioning well. In addition, there are public health measures on top of that. So we will still have masks, potentially in indoor settings. We will still have some limits on big events. You know, we will still maybe even have some density limits in public spaces. So there will be those public health measures. They matter too. And then, of course, if the case numbers get big, then we see spillover into the hospital. So they need to be prepared. A lot of work, of course, went into this early last year when we were preparing for what we then called flattening the curve of limiting the rush on hospitals. You know, we're seeing it right now in Western Sydney, you know, that once you get big case numbers, there is pressure on hospitals. But for the opening up, and we're not talking about opening up now, of course, you know, at 30%, this is not even being considered. We're talking about at 70%. 70% vaccination means that 70% of people will have significantly reduced risk of hospitalisation and death by about 95%. 70% of vaccination also significantly reduces transmission risk. So the environment we're working in is quite different when you've got high levels of vaccination, but bolstering your frontline health care, public health capabilities, maintaining the trust of the public so that we can still use public health measures, and of course making sure that our hospitals, ICUs, PPE and all the rest of it can cope with surges.
Because in New South Wales, for example, where you really have relatively few in the overall scheme of things, hospitalisations and serious cases, you're already seeing some elective surgery put off, aren't you? So the pressure is coming on significantly, even in this more benign situation than we'd be likely to get if we were open.
Absolutely, but we're only at 30% fully vaccinated. Okay, so that's the big change. Vaccinations reduce the risk of hospitalisation by 95%. That's a huge impact. So if you've got 70% of your adult population vaccinated, it's a very different setting to 30%. And in the modelling, they looked even at 50 and 60%, and opening up wasn't realistic because of the sorts of numbers. So our challenge at the moment is Delta virus in a relatively non-immune population. Over as a country, we've got very few people that have been infected, in contrast to the UK and the US, and we only have 30% of people that's vaccinated. So we're in a very different situation to what we're envisaging life will look at like when we have 70% of the population vaccinated.
What about the robustness of the testing and tracing and isolating systems? Do you think that we need to do a great deal more? Or do you think that they are fit to cope with a more open situation and COVID in the community?
You know, we're seeing test, trace, isolate systems, you know, coming under significant pressure in New South Wales currently, in an environment where we've only got 30% of people vaccinated. Many of the small states also have limited capacity. But what we have in Australia compared to the rest of the world, certainly the US and Europe, you know, we have pretty good capabilities here. When we are at 70% vaccinated and we're moving from phase A to B, and to where zero COVID is no longer the goal. It's keeping transmission potential less than one and low levels of COVID. The demands on test, trace, isolate do reduce because you've got a larger proportion of people vaccinated, you've got reduced transmission, and you're not chasing down every case to get to zero. That is what's very demanding when you're trying to find the source of every transmission event and identify, you know, how they're all linked. You don't have quite the same demand, and the focus shifts a bit when you're talking about zero COVID. So the predictions, I think we can always strengthen it. Public health capacity has been eroded in Australia over a very long time, and we saw the consequences of that back in Melbourne in, you know, July last year. There's been significant investment since, and depending on what numbers we're talking about, and I think having a national approach where different states can assist when there are different localized outbreaks, and working together as a country, each state helping each other, which we're seeing a bit of, that will all, you know, greatly put us in a good position. I can't tell you exactly whether greater capacity is really needed right now.
One significant problem, though, and I think this is being explored in some of your current modelling, is differences in regions, is weaknesses in certain cohorts of the population. We know that Indigenous Australians, for example, in the outback areas can be at high risk if an infection breaks out there. To what extent is this going to be an ongoing problem? You can't have elaborate hospitals clearly in all parts of the country.
Yeah, you raise a really important point here that when we talk about 70% vaccinated or 80% vaccinated, we mean the entire population, with particular focus on people who are most vulnerable, higher risk settings, lower socioeconomic groups, First Nations people, as you raise, cold communities. A lot of work needs to be done to absolutely ensure that those communities have these high levels of vaccination. 70% vaccination means across the board in all of these communities, and that the public health capacity is strengthened in specific communities. I mean, until now, you know, First Nations communities have done extraordinarily well with COVID because they've been prepared and had a very effective community-led response. But as this gets more complicated, it's really the public health strengthening that's needed. If the public health frontline is working together with vaccination, the load on the hospitals is significantly reduced. And it's working with those communities to ensure we've got the highest levels of vaccination, trust in the public health measures as well. And making sure that if we need the hospitalisations, that's all optimised.
Now, your modelling said that teens didn't play a key role in transmission, that it was the parents that tended to infect children and their parents. Is that still the case, do you think, now that we're seeing a lot more young people being infected?
Yeah, what the modelling did, first of all, I'll just start by saying, you know, vaccinating teens, it will be a very important part of our overall COVID response. And we already are starting to vaccinate vulnerable teens in Australia. And soon, we hope, we'll have advice that teens will also be vaccinated. What the modelling did was, it looked at what additional impact you have of vaccinating certain groups of people. And what impact would that have on lowering transmission potential? And if you vaccinated, so the modellers ran a number of different scenarios, and then they looked at what would be the additional benefit if you had 20 to 39-year-olds vaccinated, and it made a very significant difference to the transmission potential because that group are out and about socialising, going to work, etc. They then ran the model if you also added on vaccination of 12 to 15-year-olds. And to be clear, kids can certainly infect each other, as we're seeing, and they can infect adults. But the additional benefit of vaccinating that group was small. So in current environment where we want to try and move ahead as quickly as possible and as safely as possible, the biggest benefit came from you know, vaccinating that 20 to 39 year olds. That's not to say we're not going to vaccinate or don't recommend vaccinating 12 to 15 year olds at all. But while vaccines are not in surplus, if they were, this would be a no-brainer. You would just vaccinate that group. But while we've still got a somewhat supply problem, which will hopefully go away in the last quarter of the year, the priority at the moment is 20 to 39 year olds, allowing us to get to 70% vaccination rates of adults, and of course still vaccinate 12 to 15 year olds. Now, under 12s, we also, as you vaccinate, we know this in other infectious diseases, you know, that if you use targeted vaccination, the susceptible pool changes, and the susceptible pool, even after we vaccinate 12 to 15 year olds, will be under 12 too. But we know that adverse or severe outcomes from infection of kids is very rare. It's very tragic when it occurs, and it can occur, but it is very rare. And at the moment, we don't yet have the data on vaccinations in very young children.
Some experts argue that 70 to 80% vaccination of the adult population isn't enough against Delta, and we need 70 to 80% of the whole population to open safely. What do you say to those critics?
Yeah, look, there are a number of models out there, and the devil, of course, is in the detail. But I think all of the models say have a few common messages. The first is that you can't just open up with vaccination alone. I think there's great agreement on that, that you need public health measures. That's really important. The relative contribution of young adults to transmission potential, at least in the models done by the Doherty Institute-led consortium of modellers, show that it made little additional benefit on the transmission potential. Now, look, that could change as we get more information on Delta in a non-immune population. It could change if we have an environment where we have a ton of vaccines and access is not a problem. We, of course, would move very rapidly to vaccinate that group. I don't think this is, based on the modelling that's been done to date, we can move without that group vaccinated. That's what the models suggest. Now, the models will be rerun and they'll be revised. And I think it's fantastic that there are other modellers, and those modellers need to dissect and analyse and debate the details in a scientific environment. I don't think it's very useful doing it actually in the public, because these are details, and that the devil is in the detail here. But the overall principle across all the models is similar. You can't just open up at 70% with nothing else in place. There is no Freedom Day. You do need these additional public health measures. And how much emphasis on those public health measures are in the model probably explains some of the differences. And in an environment where we had unlimited vaccines, this would be a non-issue. Of course, we'd be strongly advocating vaccination for 12 to 15 year olds.
So we really do come back to supply, don't we, as the real problem that we face in trying to move forward relatively quickly.
Yeah, and I think there's also implementation issues, you know, how you implement a highly effective vaccine program and uptake in 12 to 15-year-olds will look different to adults. Where you vaccinate them, you know, so there's some logistic issues, and I think there's always a big role for education, reassurance. So, you know, there is some programmatic details that would also need to be in place to roll out vaccination successfully to a population such as 12 to 15 year olds, just as there are programmatic details that have to be dealt with and have to be optimised in First Nations communities, coal communities, difficult to reach communities, regional Australia. All of that needs a tailored vaccine response.
Now, you mentioned welcoming various modelling, but is this confusing for the community? And can you just explain to us what we should be cautious about when we talk about modelling? Because it very much depends on the information available, the assumptions, factors that often are not spelled out when politicians in particular talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, your modelling is complex, and models use a whole range of different assumptions, and they like They base those assumptions on preferably real world data that's in the public domain, whether it's Australian or international, and they will all vary a little bit in the sorts of mathematical systems they're using, as well as the assumptions. Really, really difficult for most people to understand. And so when you get this sort of debate in the public of this model's right, this model's wrong, you know, it's a massive oversimplification. I think, you know, the real messaging here is that vaccinations make a huge difference to hospitalizations, death and transmission. There is a way out, and there is light at the end of the tunnel if we combine vaccination with public health measures. And that's what we you know, aiming to do here, and make it as simple and easy for everyone to get vaccinated, and particular attention to, you know, difficult to reach groups. Now, and when we get into the, you know, percentages of and nuances of the modelling, I do think that detail does get lost on many people, creates confusion, creates doubt, and then people think, oh, the modellers, you know, don't agree, and they don't really know what they're talking about. They really do. You know, if you actually look at all the modellers that we have in this country, there's some outstanding modellers across the country, not just within this Doherty-led consortium. But you look at the detail of the report, you know, it's a 66-page report with, you know, a justification of all the different assumptions and scenarios that have been considered by this group. And many other groups have gone through that same level of detail and analysis. So I think we should look for the common messages that are very strong and very clear, and they're being used to help us find a evidence-based exit plan, which is, I think, a very good thing for us as a country. And there is an exit plan, and some principles that are common, that there are many principles that are really quite common to all the different models that you're hearing about.
It's also true, though, isn't it, that while there might be some general agreement on the principles and the main conclusions, the differences on detail can be quite important in the real world.
Oh, absolutely. And I think even with this Doherty-led consortium plan that was announced now several weeks ago, you know, I'm not so sure how many people appreciated the ongoing importance of public health measures, because many people look around the world and see, you know, countries got, you know, shut one day, open the next. That's not what we're planning here in Australia.
Now, we know that a couple of states, particularly Western Australia and Queensland, are reluctant to open their borders even when the country is much more open, because they have very few or no COVID cases. What do you say to states who say, well, why should we go from having achieved near zero COVID to having an outbreak which would come when we open?
Yeah, look, I fully understand where those states are sitting. Zero COVID is a wonderful way to live, and we enjoyed that at different times in all parts of the country, but it was not sustainable in many parts of the country. And I'm sure that in addition to zero COVID, people in those states want to travel, want to see their loved ones overseas, want to move within Australia. And opening up those borders means that zero COVID becomes very, very difficult to achieve when you can live safely with some COVID, and even, you know, easier to manage when you've got smaller cases, but you can live safely as one country with some COVID.
And what about the idea of a vaccine passport?
Yeah, vaccine passports are tricky. I think we need to use just on sort of all the sort of human rights and regulations. You know, vaccinated people, I think, once everyone's had a chance to have a vaccine, vaccinated people should have different should and justifiably can have different levels of mobility and freedom, because their risk to themselves is greatly reduced. And they're also reducing the risks of transmission. You know, there are sometimes people that can't get vaccines for whatever reason. You'd hate for those people to be discriminated against. But every single motivation we can use to vaccinate people should be taken. Vaccine passports, will almost certainly be what we'll be living with international travel. So they may well play a role in domestic travel. Still lots of issues to sort through there, I suspect.
Just finally, this whole pandemic has elevated the role of experts in a way that we haven't really seen on other issues, I think, to nearly the same extent. What do you see, what's your take out about the role of experts that we're now seeing and the way, in some cases, they've found themselves both turned into heroes, but also become caught up in the political crossfire?
Yeah, that's a challenging question. I mean, I think in many ways the pandemic has highlighted the importance of science. Let's just say that is a very good thing. Science and evidence and science informing policy, that is something that will have great benefits in many other significant global challenges we face as a country. Climate change being one of those. So it's really highlighted the role of science. Expertise is something that you could debate about. You know, what is an expert and what qualifies someone to have expertise to make commentary? I think we've seen a very wide range of expertise giving public commentary, which with the public having very limited capability to distinguish about what is true expertise or not. And yes, science informing policy, the lines can get blurred. I think the science is so important, and the dialogue between scientists and political leaders and the community is so important, and respect for each of their value is critical. But yes, people can get caught up with it. My view is, put your head down and do what you're good at. And make sure you can communicate that really well. But it's respect for science that I hope will be the enduring legacy of COVID.
Sharon Lewin, thank you so much for talking with us today. And that's all from the Conversations podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back again soon, but that's all for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.